as you can see from outside, the asylum has been taken over completely by the inmates for the day. And they are having a wonderful time. The last class was yesterday afternoon at 4 o'clock, and I have seen a few of my students sitting in the library working, but I don't think that such virtue is going to be general for the rest of this weekend. So you might find them underfoot, hanging from trees, swinging from light poles, whatever turns their fancy. But I trust that some of these things will be pleasurable to you as well. Christopher Morley, as you know, was very fond of libraries. He wrote books on booksellers. He wrote essays on what it was like to be in a book store. He tells one story, which I think is in this first section that I'm going to read you, about a lady who comes into a bookstore and wishes to take a book. And she asks the clerk, how much will it cost if I keep it over so many days? And the clerk replies, well, if you pay $3, you can keep it forever. And she says, isn't this a library? And the clerk said, no, we sell them. So the first of these little pieces is a lecture which he gave on the dedication, on the 50th anniversary of a library. We know, we practitioners of ink, that the library is our frail affiliation with the future. The librarian is the lifeguard watching over the heavy surf of today. Oh, strong swimmer require. Oh, lifesaver. Oh, life preserver. Rescue my little testimony that strangles and struggles in that treacherous undertow. Bring it safe to the shining sands, to the dunes of duration. Such is the absurdity of the human heart. We don't so much mind dying if someone will someday know that we were once alive. I also was born in a library. If by being born you mean not just the physique of parturition, but the first stirrings of intellect. I was born about the year 1898, lying on my stomach on coconut matting in the little iron gallery which runs around the north wing of the library at Haverford College. I was reading an author whom only the mature among you will remember, Captain Mayne Reid. It made a lasting impression on me. Well, that is, the coconut matting did. I still have a corrugated waffle pattern around what geographers call the Tropic of Cancer. From that day to this, some of my greatest excitements have happened in libraries. Not only in great libraries like the Bodleian or the Congressional or the New York Public, or my favorite of all, the Hartford Public Library. That is my favorite because a certain book thief specialized in stealing my books from them, and they had to keep on buying new copies. But small libraries too, even rental libraries, those alcoves of the hodiernal and the hypervendable, he loved these Greek and Latin words, which Mrs. Malaprop called an evergreen tree of diabolical knowledge. Some of you librarians from out of town have been shocked to find in the New York telephone book the entry, the Saturday Review of Literature, a pub. To avert any further misunderstanding, let me say it is not a pub in the convivial sense. And the nearest bookshop to us is a religious one which faithfully observes the church calendar. I was in there towards Easter time buying a prayer book. This is the incident I referred to. I don't know whether any of this group have noticed it, but a few years ago, a number of fine new petitions were put in the Book of Common Prayer, and I wanted to bring my orisons up to date. A lady of sorts came in, looked around, chose Anthony Adverse, and after estimating its heft, asked how long she could keep it. They said, why, if you pay $3, you can keep it forever. Oh, she said, isn't this a library? No, they said, it is a bookshop. And of course, she went away at once. And when I went out, I saw what caused her misunderstanding. Pasted on the window in ecclesiastical lettering of lavender color was a sign, Lenten Reading. Johnny Carson tells the story of a missile that gets launched toward the Soviet Union. And naturally, our officers and politicians are terribly frightened by this, and they dash to the missile silo. where they find that the man who is in charge of it is sitting there calmly eating his lunch. And they say to him, where is your missile? He says, oh, it's over there in the silo. And they say, no, it isn't. It's on the way to Moscow. And he said, that's not possible. Well, what did you do today? He said, I didn't do anything. I just punched this little red button marked lunch. A witty bookseller friend of mine, Ben Abramson in Chicago, recently wrote a piece on the influence of books on people who don't read them. What is more, there is more than mere paradox in this idea. An interesting thesis could be written about the influence of libraries on people who don't use them. Not to be a hypocrite, I am one of those. I am the kind of person who can be at his happiest in a library, but by the irony of circumstance, I am so swamped in reading matter that I rarely have a chance. But I think about libraries a good deal. They are a laboratory for the attempt at solving a great social problem, what I call the dynamics of anger. Engineers have learned to take two hostile elements, such as fire and water, or electricity and gasoline, if not hostile, at least suspicious of one another, and evidently quite partisan, and by rubbing their noses together under controlled conditions, create from their indignation beneficent power. In the library, we see a similar synthesis working on another pair of dangerous opposites, action and thought. In the library, we do not observe Allegro and Penseroso struggling for parity, deliberation getting the upper hand over mere carcass. Where else in our noisy age do you find posted and heeded the up of the immortal and heaving word, silence? The library draws its holy line, divides action from thought. The staff are active, the patrons have a chance to think. We take libraries too much for granted. Suppose librarians were to go on strike. I often wonder why they don't. A sit-down strike and a chance to read the books themselves. It is only the stone lions in front of libraries that look supercilious. The librarians themselves are very modest people, too much so. Our county seat in Nassau County has the largest jail and the smallest library I have ever seen in a town of its size. I often wonder if this mightn't be an extreme and mean proportion. Perhaps if the library were bigger, we could get along with a smaller jail. That is my word of hope. Well, I'm going to bring that to an end because I want to go on to introduce you to some of his poems. Now, I don't think that Morley was a great poet, but he is a charming poet. And he was very much influenced by Japanese writing, so that these are all very short. They are, many of them are haiku. Those of you who have been interested in Oriental writing will immediately recognize the style. But they, I assure you, are of a highly New York, Philadelphia subject matter. There is in each man's heart, this is from a book called Translations from the Chinese. There is in each man's heart, Chinese writing, a secret script, a cryptic language, the strange ideographs of the spirit, scribbled over and half erased by the swift stenography of daily life. No man can easily decipher this cordy script, this blurred text corrupted by fears and follies. But now and then, reading his own heart, so little studied such fine reading matter, he sees fragments of rubric shine through, old words of truth and trouble, illuminated in red and gold. The study of this hidden language is what I call translating from the Chinese. Now, the first of the poems, that's the dedicatory epistle, so to speak. The first of the poems is The Old Mandarin on His Travels. When I visited America, I saw two things that struck me as extraordinary. People packed in the subway, rocking uneasily on their hands, endlessly studying the newspapers. And people packed in the movies, endlessly staring at the films. I said to myself, if the American people ever develop minds, there are two great industries that will crash. This one is called An American Mystic. But you do not understand the subway, said an American mystic, sitting next to me at the Rotary Club. It is a traveling hermitage, a flying monastery, a nunnery that moves at 50 miles an hour. Into its roaring wagons, thoughtful men and women descend with joy. They know that there is the only place in the city they can meditate undisturbed. That was, of course, before recent developments in the subway.